uncooperative suspects. Fool lifted his chin, sat very still. He stared grimly at the camera, and there was in his eyes a ferocity William had not seen before. The etched grooves deep in his forehead, the raked white whiskers along his cheekbones, his stern moustaches. A soft crump as the bulb flared, and then it was done. William smiled. "Now, sir," he said loudly to Fool, "you will not want to commit any crimes on your way home tonight, or we shall certainly identify you at once." The audience laughed appreciably. Shaw laughed. William laughed. And Fool, as he got to his feet, was laughing too. Laughing and laughing, his thin lips pulled back, his sharp yellow teeth glinting, his eerie, cat-like eyes on William the while. An hour later, in the murky gaslight, William was descending the steps of Farquhar's palatial home, feeling a weariness pour through his limbs. The house was ablaze behind him, the evening still going on. He clutched under one arm a clerk's leather satchel, and inside this the Bertillon measurements of Edward Shade, photographic plates, fingerprints, a copy of the man's signature in alias, something his father had failed in his entire life. The night was very cold, and there was in him a violence which he was coming to understand, gradually, as he aged, would be the condition he was to live in always. He was his father's son. He saw again the misery in Fool's eye as he glared at the camera. On the corner, a cabman's mare was wheezing, tired head drooping, the ridge of her spine and the drag of her reins. All the horses in London were sick. William called to the driver, climbed up. The hansom set off, clattering down the cobblestones. William closed his eyes. He should have been pleased. Instead, he felt his failure, thinking of Fool outside Farquhar's study, their aborted conversation. What he should have done, he realized, was keep the man talking, hear the man out. There was a truth in any man's lies, even Edward Shade's. No, it was not finished. William swore. He would need to go back to Half Moon Street. 33. The night deepened. They were three, and they moved through the fog-bound streets, silent and blurred. A short, slight gentleman and his hulking manservant, a servant boy drifting some steps behind them. Each walked sharply in the stillness, dressed in an elegant black evening coat and a silk hat, though the small man with the pale whiskers was clearly the man in charge. He was not old, but his face was grooved and lined with care. His eyes, yes, his eyes were old. They passed the gates of Green Park and then the silent edifice of Devonshire House, and they did not see any other soul as they went, nor did they speak, nor cough, nor breathe. They paused as if to converse under a gas lamp on a corner, each man peering in a different direction. Then the boy stepped back into a doorway, and was devoured by shadow but for the white slash of knuckles and the glint of an eye, and the two men turned north along Old Bond Street, walking with a studied ease. The small man was smoking a cheroot. As they came alongside the Burlington Arcade, the small gentleman paused and studied his reflection in the windows of a tall stone art gallery, and adjusted his cuffs, and dropped the cheroot, and ground it under the toe of his shoe. He removed his gloves, dipped a hand into each pocket, sifted the chalk in his fingers. The bearded giant glanced along the street, both north and south, but saw no movement, and then, with a nod from the smaller man, he withdrew a painter's tube from under his coat and handed it across. He crouched and interlaced his fingers into a step, and the small man bit the walking stick between his teeth and looped the tube over his shoulder and stepped up onto the waiting hands. In a single fluid gesture, the giant lifted the small man high over his shoulders, and the small man coiled and leaped into the air, and he caught the stone sill of the second-story window. He swung a long, slow moment. Already below him, the giant was melting back into the shadows. He folded his legs and swung to the left, and hooked an elbow and a forearm onto the sill and hoisted himself up. It was a shallow sill, just wide enough for him to crouch sideways on one knee, and the first thing he did was to pull back on his gloves. He then quickly unscrewed the tip of his cane, and withdrew the short iron jemmy there, and leaned into the casement, and cracked the lock in a smooth, sharp, powerful movement. The broken lock clattered to the floor within, and he sat listening, and then he tucked the walking stick under one arm and drew the window noiselessly upward, and he was in. It was an unfurnished room, he knew it well. There was no light, but for the weak gaslight coming up from the street. But even still he could see on the far wall the tall portrait of Emma Hamilton, gazing sorrowfully out at him. He stood for what seemed a long time, staring at her in reverie, though it could not have been more than several minutes. Then he got to work. He walked to the door and stood listening for the guard on his rounds, but at first he could hear no sound at all, and then a long, slow shirring, like waves on a beach at night, came to him, and he smiled. The guard was asleep. He took off his frock coat and laid it open on the floor, its arms loose and sprawled, like some collapsed victim. From the coat lining he withdrew the wooden doorstop and wedged it under the door. He crossed to the wall and hoisted the velvet rope aside, and with great care he lifted the painting from its hook and set it face up on the floor. The gilt frame was heavy and worth several hundred pounds itself. He removed from his coat pocket the small jar of paste and a sharp folding knife, and he opened the blade. The canvas was strong and thickly woven, and he sawed slowly, and he did not hurry. He was careful to cut behind the edge of the frame, and not to damage the visible image in any fashion. When he had finished, he turned the painting upside down, and unscrewed the jar of paste, and dabbed the end of the velvet rope into the paste. He moistened the back of the canvas to make it more supple. Every few minutes, he would pause and lift his face to listen. He rolled the painting with its image turned outward to keep the paint pliable and to prevent its cracking, slid the canvas into the hard tube, screwed a cap onto its end, left the frame lying shabby and ravished on the floor of the gallery. He did not hesitate. He put back on his coat and collected the doorstop and his walking stick, and he paused at the sill to be certain he had left nothing behind. Then he folded his legs out the window, drew the casement shut, bit down on his walking stick, and rubbed his forearm over the edge of the sill, until his chalky fingerprints had been wiped clear. Then he swung himself down with a casual grace, until he was again hanging from the windowsill by his fingertips, and let go, and dropped the 15 feet to the ground. The giant reappeared, smoothed the back of the man's coat, adjusted the collar. At the corner, the boy stepped out of the shadows and joined them. No one spoke. They walked unhurriedly back along Piccadilly, paused at the corner of Half Moon Street just long enough for the small man to light a second cheroot and glance about for witnesses, and then all three slipped away among the houses there and were gone. 17 minutes had passed. Any man lurking on that street would have seen a light go on in the second floor window of number 82, and then the heavy drapes pulling shut, and the house again going dark. 34. Years later, when he would think of the funeral and all that attended it, a fog would descend, brown and slow, blurring the edges of his grief. Somewhere in that haze were the facts of it. His father fallen hard and having bit through his tongue, and the gangrene setting in. The septicemia that killed him. That. But when William later recalled those weeks, in July of 1884, there was always that other thing, a haze of sorrow, obscuring all. Had it seemed so in the moment? He could not recall. Moments are like that, Margaret liked to say. Moments are seeming, or they are nothing. On the second morning after his father's death, he had stood before the pier glass in the hall, while Margaret adjusted his collar and set her cool hand at his heart, and he had looked down at her. Her eyes like sunlight on green river stones, her eyes like the quiet after a long applause. He asked her if it wasn't too early to go across. She told him he was a good man. He asked if the coffee in the carafe was still warm, and she told him she would see. Fireworks had lit up the sky for 2 nights running. It was the Independence celebrations. They had sat on the veranda of his mother's house in silence, while the girls slept within, and had watched the spill of broken light, and felt the traces on their eyelids in the warm air. After each explosion, his brother Robert had cleared his throat and coughed until William could not stand it, and he had got to his feet and bid them all good night. His mother had risen from the old swinging bench and come to him and held him, and he had felt embarrassed by the heat of it all.
"A small funeral,"
she said to them in the morning kitchen.
"Och, that would be best."
"Immediate family only," he agreed. Robert brooded. Robert disapproved. He thought a show of public mourning more suitable.
"You'll not,"
their mother insisted.
"I'll not see that for the poor man ever."
The block of butter melting languidly in its dish, a fly battering itself against a pane. Robert meeting William's eye over her head and holding it while the clock on the landing sounded the hour. By then the obituaries had already begun in the national dailies and the international papers as well, and their mother clipped each one with her ancient, heavy sewing shears and pasted them into a memory book with thick leather covers and wide pages and a ghoulish lock of their father's hair. William could not bring himself to go to it, though Margaret sat with her for hours, leafing through it. The obituaries were posted over from the New York office, and Robert thought to instruct them to cease, but William told him to leave it alone. Robert scowled.
"It's unhealthy, Willie."
"It's what she has left," he said.
All that week, William slept little. In the mornings, he ate an early breakfast of steak and eggs, and left the house with his collar unironed and vest unbuttoned. In his father's sunlit bedchamber, he would go idly through the clothes with Robert, dabbing a wet cloth to his lips, the muslin curtains glowing. They had done so as boys, too, when their father was away on business, and William thought of this with a sudden upwelling of sorrow. A Bible sat on the nightstand, a paper folded to mark its place. The paper was blank. His father and his faith. Wherever he might be now. In the mid-morning, their mother would come with cups of tea and kiss them on the tops of their heads and go. What he was thinking, sifting through his father's suits, was the power and vitriol that flesh had once held. He could count on the fingers of a single hand the times his father had confided in him, had looked at him with pride, had sought his judgment or advice. The old man had been impossible, unpredictable. William would smooth his fingers over the fabric of a lapel, lift his father's sleeve. The worn cloth, light as a wasp's nest. Robert coughing someplace near. He had always been the favored son. That from Robert, not in resentment. His first operation without oversight, the Farrington business, had ended in brutality, a kind of failure, and he had feared his father's wrath. He could still recall the taste of metal in his mouth, the dread as he had descended the arrivals platform in Chicago. But instead of disappointment, he had met with the fierce, satisfied grip of his father's hand on his sleeve, a long, shrewd grin of approval. There were newsmen crowded at the station exit, calling for comment, and his father had taken William's suitcase from him, and nodded, and let him walk through first. The Farrington brothers were sullen, black-bearded behemoths, with fists the size of a man's skull. Each had stood near 7 feet tall, and the smaller of the two had wrists so thick, William had had to rig the cuffs to fix him. That was Hillary. Levi could crack a squirrel at 50 yards if the light was right. They had worked a Southern Express company safe out of $20,000 at Union City with 3 other men, and holed up in a rickety general store in the swamps near Lester's Landing, Kentucky. It had been a botched hunt from the first, and when he at last stormed their hideout, he took a bullet to the gut in thanks. He'd gone in at dusk through the swamps with a former Memphis policeman, whose fingertips had been buffed to softness and were quick on the hammer, and with 2 cane-fed whites, who poled the skiff in a mistrustful silence. There were birds screeching in the twilight, the dirty river pushing sluggishly past the woodyard and landing. That general store was a rough log cabin built on stilts, with a door at either end, and a single window covered by bearskin. Through it, an eerie orange light from an oil lamp was visible. He remembered the silence of that place, how he had walked in through the front door while the ex-cop had circled around back, and how he had found 5 men and a woman sitting in the room playing cards, and how he had asked casually for directions to the Tiptonville Road. Levi had risen huge and shaggy like a cave bear, and he shot first and hit William, and then he turned,
shot low through the closed back door, hit the ex-cop, crouched there. Then he kicked through that door in a splinter of wood and nails and knocked the wounded man aside and vanished into the swamps. William had set to, swinging his fists and his revolver and lumber and furniture, until no man stood against him. He had been bleeding badly, but the bullet had only just taken the skin with it. The button of the ex-cop's heavy Kentucky denim had turned aside the other shot, and passed it under the skin to the man's back. Afterwards, William had forced the woman to hold the candle while he cut out the slug with a corn knife. Then word came in that the other brother, Hillary, had been seen near Verona, Missouri. They found him holed up in a settler's cabin on the edge of the Indian Territory. The man was in place with rifles and ammunition, and was slowly picking off the posse William had gathered. He pulled his deputies back, and thought about it, and went among the posse until he found the cabin's owner, and he bought the place outright for $200. He outfitted a wagon with hay and rolled it against the cabin wall, and was prepared to set it alight when the big man came out with his hands empty. "Why, hello, Hillary," William had called out with a grin. 2 days later, he had engaged a stateroom on the steamer Illinois, bound for Columbus, Kentucky. Hillary Farrington, huge and hairy and quiet, where he crouched on the cot. He was too tall to lie down, and so sat up into the night, and after a long while, William had offered him a drink in the saloon. What was it in him that pitied a man as terrible and vicious as that? What had gone wrong in him, his father used to ask. The night air had been warm. The big man had raised his cuffed hands over William's head as they got up on deck with an easy gentleness, as if to embrace him, and then he crushed him against the rail and reached for the Colt at William's hip, and neither man had said a word. They had wrestled in silence, just grunts, muffled gasping over the quiet slap of river against the hull. When the Colt went off, the sound seemed desperate and sudden and real. Something changed in their struggle then. The bullet had grazed William's scalp, and there was blood running into his eyes. Hillary had him by the throat when William twisted the man sideways and up over the rail, and then Hillary was gone into the darkness of the paddle wheel. There was the sound of it. There would always be the sound of it. The crunch and whoomp and weird watery slapping of a heavy body diced and shunted and sprayed outward in a dark cloud under the river. William had slid down onto the deck, with his back pressed against the posts of the railing, and shook and shook. If any part of the man was ever dredged up, he never heard it. 2 weeks later, his brother Robert beat Levi to a pulp in the main street of Farmington with the butt of a revolver, and the matter was closed. The morning of the funeral dawned grey, muggy, a weird light shining behind the clouds and casting no shadow. They had hired two long black carriages and rode to the church in a grim silence, and William wondered at the nothingness he felt, the pale faces surrounding, his daughters quiet at his side. The church itself was cold and grim, and the pews felt wrong to him, hard and uncomfortable. He shifted his weight, but could find no trick to it. When he rose to speak, his voice sounded thin to his own ears, strained, as if he had not slept and did not believe his own words. The old Chicago attorney, Luther Mills, declared his father a reformer, a great man fighting the evils of the modern world. He and his brother and George Bangs and three others carried the coffin out to the hearse. It was not heavy. They might have been carrying furniture. The horses stamped in harness. Low white fences, porches, oaks, then the wrought iron gates of Graceland Cemetery. The black-ribboned wreaths and heavy white flowers lining the gateposts, dragging against their own weight, as in a slow current of sorrow. The small knot of newspaper men standing respectfully aside. What did he recall of that morning? Margaret's gloved hand on his wrist. He could hear his frail mother weeping, and he peered around him, but could not comprehend what he saw. Figures in black, grey faces. The pastor had fallen silent with the book closed upon one finger, and he extended a sorrowful hand that all there might bow their heads, all but one, and that one glared about him with a hollowness where once had been some gentler thing. Somewhere across that green field of the dead, a bell was tolling. There were stones and monuments gleaming whitely under the strange light, the rain-blown sky steeped in it. Nearby lay Kate Warne, decomposing in her burial clothes, and the remains of Ignatius Spar, attendants both, and buried with their liege, and William thought of this, and then he tried not to. He felt light-headed, sick. He stepped forward with his brother, and together they took up the shovels and turned them. A scrape of iron, a sift and slide of dry soil and small stones. Robert's eyes were wet. He could hear Margaret crying softly near him. He stood like that at the edge of the earth, staring down into darkness, the cold sky whirling over his head, and he felt the worst of it enter him like a sickness and settle there in his blood. The worst of it. Yes, that. What he felt was not grief, or not grief only. Not grief only, but also the black, amoral joy of a man adrift. He had nowhere he needed to be. What he felt, staring down at his father's rosewood coffin, was relief. 35. When the knocking came, it came urgent, maddened, and they froze each across from each in full study, and locked eyes, thinking the same thing. The hour had passed midnight and not stopped. Fool could feel the blood loud in his ears. He did not think the yard could have traced them so quickly. Then he knew in a sudden swift panic who must be outside. Pinkerton. He had not yet told the others of his humiliation at the dinner party. Flood withdrew from a hidden sheath behind the bookcase, a long, curved blade, an evil thing Fool hated the sight of. He gestured at Molly, and she started to roll the painting carefully back up in its scroll. He did not kill the lamps. In the hall, where no lights burned, he drew aside a corner of the curtain, but he could not see the step, nor the big American, with his dead eyes and strangler's hands. He thought of what Pinkerton had done to those rampsmen with their coshes in the alley behind the Lascars, and he set his jaw and hurried. He could hear the knock sounding again, and there was something else, a kind of scraping he could not identify. He wondered if the detective was picking the front lock. Flood went to the stairs, moving with a murderous silence, and Fool, in his study, peeled off his frock coat and his shirt, as Molly held out his robe, wordlessly. He clawed his hands through his hair to muss it. When he descended, he found Flood already looming silent in shadow. Fool did not look at the knife in his fist. He could see through the stained glass of the door the blurred outline of an arm, a shoulder, but no distinguishing mark to them, and he felt all at once the hairs on the back of his neck stand on end. The knocking sounded a third time, angry, commanding. "Yes, yes! Coming!" Fool called out irritatedly. He had a hand on the bolt to draw it back, when he saw, too late, that he still wore his shoes, crusted with the filth of the streets. He knew Pinkerton would see it at once, but there was nothing to be done. He opened the door. A cold blackness, a rush of freezing air on his face. There, on the step, with one fist upraised and darkness tangling her hair, stood Charlotte Reckitt. He stared at her in confusion. "Charlotte?" he whispered. "Hello, Adam," she said, and her voice was what he remembered. Water in sunlight. American Detective, 1862. Virginia. He was no one's son. He was small, with black whiskers still coming in, and burning violet eyes, and a soft accent that might have been Virginian, and there seemed a great beauty in him, like a buried suffering. In that second week of May, 1862, he was still a boy, and the seething streets of Richmond still mysterious. He wore Confederate grey as if it belonged on him, a man among men, nodding his slow nod to all. His uncle had been with Jackson in the Shenandoah, he said. No, they were not licked yet, he said. He was down from Baltimore, the only son of a captured courier there, and he had carried his father's mails across the lines, and no, sir, he did not think he would go north again. He could be found staring across the grey river in the morning light, running his fingers over the malformed lump of his left shoulder, as if to massage a limb that was no longer. There was smoke rising above the Chickahominy. He smoked and shared his tobacco with any who asked. Officers with sabers at their sides, stiff white gloves shining. Barefoot boys younger than himself running messages from the 23rd Virginia at Camp Lee. In the afternoons, the Capitol gleamed its marble truth over a martial city, and the clatter of regimental drums could be heard from the old fairgrounds. And all day the guns, on their great wheels, would bog down in the streets, and the powerful horses would heave against their weight in the muck, and old men would come out of the shop fronts, wiping their hands on their aprons to watch. He walked among them, one of them, fierce. But he was not that one. In truth, he had been sent from the north to move among them like a viper through tall grass, and he felt the poison of it, as if he was sick with it himself. The man who had sent him was a burly Scot, with hard hands and a barrel chest, and caustic blue eyes, and who answered to the Union rank of major. The boy's task was clear. Break 2 Union spies from prison before they perished by bullet or by rope or by plague. He was alone in that enemy capital, without ally or recourse. And should he fail or be caught, he would meet his death blindfolded and roped to a stake under a hail of executioner's fire, and be kicked into a shallow grave outside the walls of Richmond. No man would know to mourn his loss. No man but one. 1 week earlier, while a dying sun reddened below the tree line, Edward had stood in a clearing, south of the Union pickets, watching as the porters finished their preparations. The journey would take most of the night. The major stood with a hand on the boy's shoulder as if to claim him for his own, his hat pulled low to conceal his face. Ben trudged the perimeter of the wagon and squatted to check its axles, then rose and tightened the straps on the withered mule. Sally called to her husband some instruction, and then gathered her skirts and clambered into the flatbed and kicked through the straw for buried supplies. When both were satisfied, they straightened and regarded the boy. No one spoke. Edward held a tied bedroll under one arm, and he had wrapped the small ivory-handled pistolet in an oilskin and stuffed it into the bedding, and he carried nothing else. He gave the major a look, and the older man nodded and stepped back. Sally was crouched in the straw, a shawl at her shoulders. Edward and Ben climbed up onto the bench seat, crushed together. In the gathering dusk, the flies were biting. Edward swiped at his throat. When he glanced back, the major was already gone. Darkness came on. They rode east and then south and then east again in the night forest. A single lantern burned weakly on a rod over the mule's crooked back, casting all into eerie relief. Ben had removed his earrings and gold chain, and without a weapon at his side, he looked somehow more sinister, more dangerous. He led them down ancient grassy tracks through the forest, and twice he lost his way, and retraced his steps, and they went on. They passed a solitary house standing dark in a clearing, but no one came out to greet them, and they rolled creaking past and did not stop. At the marshy shores of the James, Edward got down and took up his bedroll and his small hat, and he nodded to the porters, and they nodded gravely in return.
"Godspeed,"
Sally murmured. Ben shifted on the bench, clicked the reins.
"You'll be safe now," he grunted.
Edward walked the remaining distance alone. The moon was out, and once on to the riverbank, the light was enough to go by. He was careful to wade through mud and wipe his shirt cuffs and backside with dirt and bark. He slept that night in a stone farmhouse, under the baleful glower of 2 widowed sisters. They were gold-skinned, with long Iberian faces and sad eyes, and dressed alike in grey homespun dresses, and might have been twins to Edward's eye. Rebel sympathizers both, and key links in a Confederate 5th column. Before dawn, a boy his own age in ragged trousers stood whistling at the gate with a lobster cage slung over one shoulder, and the sisters woke him and gave him a packet of cold chicken and corn cakes and led him across the yard in their nightdresses, like homesteaders fleeing a fire. Edward had felt nothing at first, neither fear nor dread nor gratitude. The boy rowed him across the smoky waters to the Confederate shore and shipped his oars at the far bank and folded his fingers to his mouth and called a bird cry into the ominous woods for the pickets to know. Edward huddled in the stern, watching the water run down the oar shafts in the half-light, listening to the waves slap at the hull. When he stepped from the slow roll of the rowboat into the shallows to splash ashore, a soldier materialized out of the trees, with his Enfield lowered and his eyes lost in shadow. The Confederates had commandeered a thatched cottage 2 miles away, and a peat fire was burning in its hearth when they arrived, and Edward held his hands to the smoulder of it, nervous. He fumbled his pass from the cuff of one soaked boot with stiff fingers. The infantry captain interviewing him sat on a three-legged stool before the fire, huddled in a blanket, and he seemed very tired. Edward watched the day come on through the dirty windows, and when asked, he unstitched a packet of letters from the lining of his coat and passed them across. The captain told Edward passes were being revoked. Spies had been at work, he explained. There was a Union force preparing to march on Richmond. Edward nodded, said nothing. The captain said he had not seen his wife and daughters in over a year, and he did not believe he would see them again. He said his smallest had been born blind. There were tiny etched lines at the corners of the man's eyes, and his lashes were so pale as to look dusted in the early light. "Well, son," he said, "tell Mr. Davis if you see him, there are brave men here who just want to fight and be done with it." Somewhere bacon was sizzling in a pan. A man was coughing. Somewhere a door had been left ajar. Everything lay still before him, a lifetime yet unlived. He walked in the middle of the road and was picked up by a passing wagon carrying bolts of silk to Richmond, and when he reached the city, he again showed his pass, and was escorted under armed guard to a nondescript stone building behind a hedge. He was instructed to report to the intelligence gatherer Cashmere on the second floor. He swallowed uneasily, stared at his scuffed boots, then went up. In an airy antechamber, he was told to wait, and sat under a tall portrait of Jefferson Davis, drumming his fingers on his knees, and through the windows he could hear birds singing. The gentleness of the light, the elegance of the marble pillars beyond the doors, were at odds with the cruelty of its purpose. For the major had warned him about this place. No traveller entered Richmond without first registering with Cashmere's people. He was the rebels' Pinkerton, a captain in the Confederate Secret Service, and an investigator out of the Provost Marshal's office serving under General Winder, and one of the men responsible for the arrest of Lewis and Scully and the hanging of Timothy Webster. He had fingers, Southerners said, like a spider. A soldier came out, studied him, unimpressed. "Come," he said, "let's go." Edward rose, rumpled, yet in his traveling clothes, mud crusted on his boots. Cashmere got up from behind his desk and shook Edward's hand, and gestured to a sofa under a window. He offered tea, biscuits. The man had very small ears turned outward from his head. He was wide-shouldered, his blonde hair thinning. His eyes were so dark as to look black in the sunlight. "Your uncle was in the Shenandoah," Cashmere said.
"Yes, sir."
"I know your father. I was sorry to hear of his arrest."
"Spies, sir,"
Edward said, letting a venom creep into his voice.
"Someone spoke out of turn, I reckon. Sold him out."
"Any idea who?"
Edward shook his head angrily. "I'd cut his throat if I knew it, sir."
Cashmere sucked his lips into a frown, studied the boy. Then he rose and crossed to the window and peered through the slats with his face hidden. "He never mentioned he had a boy. You have some color to you, son." Edward cleared his throat.
"My mother was Spanish."
"Spanish?"
"Yes, sir."
"The Spaniards are the niggers of Europe," Cashmere said softly. "It is a sad fact, but true. That is what comes of a history of being conquered." He stared out of the window at the streets of Richmond, lost in thought. "A lad has 2 bloodlines in him. Which will be the stronger? Does he have a say in it, or is he already what he will be?" Edward said nothing. Cashmere grunted, half-turned, hand still clasped at his back. "Some would say that is what this war is about. A man's right to choose his own self. Is the North to rule without our consent? Or do we have a right to our own destiny?"
"Yes, sir."
Cashmere turned back to the window. "But they would be wrong," he murmured,
That is not what this war is about. A moment passed. Edward stood with his hands damp at his sides, waiting. The captain said nothing more, and at last Edward said,
Sir?
Casimir turned, as if surprised the boy was still there. Welcome to the Free Confederacy, son, he said. There'll be a room for you at the Spotswood. We'll find a use for your talents yet. He took a room on the third floor of the Spotswood Hotel, as instructed, and rose early the next morning and walked uphill to the Capitol through the rain. The days began their slow passing. A Negro chambermaid near his age made eyes at him each morning, but he ignored her. He recorded what he could in a small notebook at night by candlelight, though he sent no reports out. The breastworks were of split pine logs, with a 64-pounder and a traverse of 180 degrees, he wrote. There were 17 batteries surrounding the capital, he wrote. The defending soldiers were equipped with Enfields from England, smuggled in via Bermuda. He observed that sickness had thinned the ranks of the infantry, but that the cavalry remained strong, and he noticed that hay of any quality was scarce, the prices wild and fluctual. He estimated some 75,000 fighting men stood to arms in Richmond. He hid the notebook and the small ivory-handled pistolet between his mattress and the headboard. He did not approach the prisons. Edward walked now among the Confederate officers in the rain, and he saw the same faces as in the north, the same fever, same youth, same blood. In his second week in Richmond, he made his way out to the old fairgrounds at Camp Lee, and stared at the scaffold that stood yet where Timothy Webster had been hanged. The grass was still trampled down to mud from the crowds that day, and he stood on a low rise, alone, against the cloudy light, and stared across at the devastation of it. Webster had died well, had warned the soldiers to make the noose tight. Edward never met the man, but wished he had. The two spies remaining, John Scully and Price Lewis, had been arrested 7 weeks earlier while trying to locate Webster, and when Webster went to the scaffold, and they did not, rumors started up. It was said Lewis had betrayed him to his death. It was said Scully had revealed the Major's networks in the South. But the two men remained in prison, and the Major did not believe the talk, and Edward, if nothing else, trusted the Major. In the last days of May, after McClellan had taken Mechanicsville, and the Union guns rolled to within 5 miles of the city, he became aware of a man following him. The man wore a long, unkempt beard and stained grey trousers, like a labourer down on his luck, but his eyes were clear and very blue. Everywhere a quiet hardness lay across the city, and its inhabitants waded through the muddy streets with their hats low, and their eyes fierce in the knowledge of what was coming. Edward would leave his hotel in the morning, and see the man lounging in a doorway across the street, thumbs hooked in his pockets, his watch chain glinting in the sunlight. An able-bodied man in the heart of the Confederacy doing nothing, conspicuously. He learned from a shoeshine boy that the man was an agent of Cashmere's, and something cold and evil turned over inside him to hear it. He had by that time worked out several plans to free Lewis and Scully, but each time, as the hour drew near, some unexpected interference arose. He had learned that the two men were being held in Castle Godwin, a fierce, scorched brick building set back from Carey Street, with grim, slitted windows in its rear, and a rotted fence running the perimeter. He had taken to walking past it on his morning rounds, but he ceased doing so in his uneasiness. At first he had thought to work his way into the prison as a visitor, but when that seemed to draw too much attention, he had abandoned it, and began to collect sticks of dynamite for an assault when the Union Army began its shelling. As the shells struck, he would shatter one wall of the prison from earth to sky, and walk through that breach and carry Lewis and Scully to freedom. Then McClellan hesitated at the Chickahominy, and did not advance, and then Edward grew anxious, and started to look for another way. He cultivated a friendship with one of the younger wardens, thinking to find some weakness there. But that man was redeployed into Lee's army and killed at Glendale, and Edward did not think it wise to approach another. What he needed, in fact, was some accomplice, some second man. Then, in the second week, Cashmere's agent was replaced by a different man, much older, and in the third week, Lee began his counterattack, and the infernal week boiled over in all its fury,
and the Union forces were pushed back past Malvern Hill, and Edward found himself again alone. He was ogling the windows of a harness-maker's display on Carey Street in early July, when he saw, in the rippled glass, two dark figures pass at his shoulder. He stood very still, his own reflection blurred and pale. Then he turned and followed. This was after the Union retreat, after the slaughter of Malvern Hill. He was trapped in Richmond by then. He followed the men towards the centre of the city and walked slow and kept his distance. The smaller of the two, a man with a bony neck and a delicate white suit, spoke furtively and rapidly. The taller only listened. Then the taller nodded farewell and slipped alone past the lintel of a storefront and inside. Edward crossed the street at a jog, followed him in. It was a butcher's shop, and the man he sought stood at the counter with his back to Edward, and he was holding out a hand for a wrapped paper package. The man chuckled and tipped his hat to the butcher, and brushed past Edward's shoulder, and a moment later the shop door banged open, and then he was gone, without so much as a glance Edward's way. His beard had come in since Edward had seen him last, yes. His accent was thicker here in the heart of the Confederacy, but the scars were the same. Ignatius Spar. At breakfast the next morning, Edward found the two men in silent concentration over plates of sausages and eggs, and he sat at their table in his grey cotton suit and took off his hat and held out a hand. Both men lifted their faces, surprised, interested, calculating. Spar took Edward's right hand in an awkward left-handed grip, grunted in greeting. His companion set down his knife and fork, smiled. He was an attorney at law out of Texas named Marvell. "I've seen you about, son," Spar said pleasantly, still chewing. "You're that courier came down out of Baltimore. Folks say you crossed the lines alone."
"Yes, sir." Edward dipped his head. "My mama always said I was lucky as a duck in a puddle."
"I couldn't speak to luck, young man," the attorney said, "but you're certainly brave."
"Thank you, sir."
"His father was arrested, Mr. Marvell, in Baltimore."
Marvell crushed his eyes shut in sympathy.
"I am sorry to hear that, I am."
"You're not from Richmond, either of you, then?"
Marvell chuckled.
"I don't know as anyone is, really."
Edward lifted an eyebrow, smiled vaguely.
"I'm just to passin' through myself," Spar said. "I come up here to the capital on wheat business, trying to establish some sort of norm to keep the prices steady. Won't do if our boys all starve to death before they have a chance to knock on Mr. Lincoln's door."
He smiled around the room in the clean July sunlight, and then he fixed his pale eyes on Edward, and he held his gaze, smiling with all his long teeth, his burned skin webbed with scars. Edward looked away.
"And what's your business in the capital, Mr. Marvell?"
"Ah, his is an interesting affair," Spar said.
Marvell wiped at his mouth, set his crumpled napkin in a ball on his plate.
"I'll tell you, son. You've heard of those spies captured here in Richmond last April?"
"I heard a little, sir."
Marvell shrugged. "Well, I've come to offer my services to the Confederacy, to defend those two men in the case."
Edward smiled a confused smile.
"Defend them?"
Marvell nodded.
"I don't understand. You mean you want to help them?"
The attorney laughed.
"I don't wish to help them, no. There's no helping those men. I wish to help the Confederacy. They shall need to go to trial, and when they do, the law requires they be provided with counsel. You might say I have come to expedite the process."
"To expedite it?"
"It's all somewhat strange, son," Spar interjected, "but it wouldn't do for the Confederacy to appear to be flouting its own laws. We have allies we need to court, see? Britain, France, and such. It makes it far harder for Mr. Davis to draw in their support if we appear to be less than lawful. Is that about the matter of it, Mr. Marvell?"
Marvell smiled. "And to think I feared I had bored you, sir, with all my talk yesterday." Edward had always liked Spar in spite of himself. There was in him something brutal and merciless, but, too, the man could be easy and fine and strong. Someone had told Edward once that Spar never won a game of cards against a private, and never lost a game to an officer. They rose now from their breakfast, with Edward wiping at his mouth, and they went out into the white sunlight of that July street, the smell of the heat coming off the walls of the buildings, and the dust under the hooves of the passing horses, their shadows long and crooked before them. Marvell took his leave, a nod and two fingers to his brim, an excuse. Edward and Spar walked on slowly, talking the while. When clear of Ennie's earshot, Edward dropped the accent and said, "Affable fellow. Interesting line of work. How did you meet?"
"Would you believe by chance?"
Edward cast a sharp, sidelong look. "I don't believe I would." The man ran a finger along his ravaged lip, where the sweat was already beading. They had been walking west through the city, and they made their way out towards Camp Lee, where Webster had been hanged those 2 months gone, the scaffold long since dismantled, the grass scavenged and yellow.
"What are you doing here, Mr. Spar?"
Spar kicked a heel through the rough and gave Edward a long, cool look.
"The Major sent me," he said at last. "I came to find you."
"To find me?"
Spar nodded.
"Is there a message?" "Yes, there's a message."
Edward waited, but Spar said nothing, only picked at his teeth with a long blade of grass, and stared thoughtfully down at the camp, the soldiers drilling there, the guns and horses gleaming in the sunlight.
"What's the message?"
Spar's hairline glistened in the heat.
"I've been sent to bring you back, Edward," he said. "I've been sent to get you out."
That very night, Spar strode into Edward's hotel and tucked his walking stick under one sleeve and argued loudly with the clerk for a reservation that ought to have been in place, but was, to his great astonishment, not registered, and Edward happened by and interjected politely that if there was some error, he would be pleased to share his own room. The clerk stared at him in relief. "Oh, but there were two beds, one on either side of a street-facing window, and he did not mind, no, anything to help a fellow patriot, gentlemen." Spar's orders had been clear. He was to locate Edward and smuggle him north again, under the cover of a private loss. He had left a loaded cart and horse at a farmstead 3 miles west of the city, and he would take Edward through the trees to that isolated spot at the earliest moment. When Edward asked how he had crossed the lines during the fighting at Malvern Hill, Spar got a strange look, and the cords stood out in his neck, and he said, tiredly,
"The Major wants you back in one piece, Edward. We need to go."
Edward gave him a cautious look. Something did not seem right, though he could not explain it.
"I can't," he said. "Not yet. Not until I've done what I came here to do."
Spar raised an eyebrow.
"Meaning what?"
"You don't know?"
Spar shrugged.
"I don't know what you were sent here to do, son. My instructions don't take it into account."
Edward frowned and rose and crossed to the door and listened.
"No one's listening, Edward. We're quite secure. What's your purpose here?"
But Edward crossed the room again and sat next to Spar and cupped a hand at the man's ear and whispered,
"I could use your help. I'm here to break Lewis and Scully from Godwin."
Spar pulled back, squinted at Edward.
"The hell you are," he said. "Alone? Who have you contacted? How do you aim to proceed?"
Edward met the scarred man's eye and smiled.
"About that," he whispered, "your Mr. Marvell might prove of use."
A day passed, a second, the two men turning over in their heads possible approaches. He told Spar about Cashmere and General Winder's undercover agents. Marvell had come to offer his services to the Confederacy, and as such would have access to the two prisoners. Access, Edward brooded, that he himself had failed to secure. If Marvell could be drawn to their purpose, then a plan might be executed. Spar disagreed. His methods were the more brutal. On the third night, Spar slipped out into the darkness alone and returned an hour later with blood flecking his wrists and trousers, his blue eyes haunted. Edward locked the door behind him.
"What did you do?"
he hissed.
"What needed to be done?"
he said. "Mr. Marvell will not trouble us now." The next morning, Spar walked to Winder's headquarters to report his presence in Richmond and to offer his services as counsel. He returned with a slow, wide grin and tipped Edward's hat playfully back on his head and said,
"They've heard of me, Mr. Marvell, who successfully found against cattle thieves in Texas. They found my offer rather compelling."
Edward grinned. But there was a strange look on Spar's face sometimes when he thought Edward was not watching him. In the afternoons, Spar would vanish into the cold halls of Castle Godwin to meet with Lewis and Scully and weigh their health and condition against what would be required of them, and Edward would begin to prepare their escape. He had Spar press an imprint of the warden's keys, and then had a duplicate copy made, and he took to walking through the hotel stable yard with an apple for the old sorrel in its stall there. He bought items of spare clothing from several different shops over the course of a week, and he was careful to wear some of them when he went out. He bought 2 pairs of boots. Spar took an interest in Edward's earlier failed attempts and grilled him on the names of his accomplices. He said it was to prevent such mistakes being repeated. Edward did not entirely believe him. Spar smuggled the duplicate keys to Lewis. He told Edward that the 2 men were kept from each other, and that they were thin and depressed, and there was an anger in Scully that was not in Lewis. He said Lewis would run his fingers over the edges of the bricks in the wall of his cell with a kind of obsessive calm, and he feared the 2 men were weakening. One morning, as Edward was inspecting the wheels of the small straw-filled cart in the yard, the hotel clerk came out with a message for him, and he realized he would need to be more careful. He had already visited John P. Jones, seeking a pass north, and had suffered the clerk's ferret-like stare and sour questions, but now upon his return he was given his requested papers without a second glance. That, too, should have given him pause. On the evening of the 12th, he and Spar walked again back out to Camp Lee as if to take the air, and there Edward drew in the dust with a stick a rough map of the city, and he went over the following night's plan, and then he wiped the map clear with the toe of his boot, and gave Spar the stick, and had Spar explain it all to him word for word. "You've got the one chance at this, kid," Spar told him. "You come north with me, whatever happens." Evening faded. Cicadas sang. The linden trees were eaten by shadow. Then the stars wheeled up over the horizon, and the skyline was sucked down, and the man-made lights of the world came on one by one, until the face of the earth and the face of the waters burned alike with pinpricks of light. Edward nodded. "Tell it to me one more time," he said. Finally, a night would come, years after the war, when he would sleep a long, dreamless sleep, when he would not wake with one hand lurching for a pistol, and his eyes roving through the darkness. There would be great fields of the ploughed dead by then, and half a nation still smouldering in ruins, and he would stand at the cold hotel window of a city across the ocean and stare out at the bird-stained horsemen in their stone shakos, and marvel at the ancient cruelty. The war would end. The dead would not. That was the dawn of industrial war, and Edward would understand only slowly that killing on such a scale could be a kind of commerce. When he knew that, he knew some faith in his fellow man had been compromised, and he could not come back from it. He would wonder about the boy, James Gray, from Mrs. Shade's estate, whom he had not thought of in years. That boy had been 2 years his elder, and ripe for enlistment, and he would wonder if his bones lay now in some field of the Ohio, rolled in a man's coat 2 sizes too big, or scattered in pieces under the muck of some earthworks long overrun and gone to grass. He had seen too many dead to think otherwise. But perhaps the boy had gone west, or died in the poorhouse before the war began. On the night of the new moon, he and Spar walked out of their hotel together in the quarter hour after 10 o'clock. They carried nothing but their jackets, and they did not slow as they passed through the lobby. They wore their derby hats low. Outside, Edward slipped down an alley and entered the rear stables through an unlocked gate in the fence, and Spar took his hand and wished him safe passage. They would rendezvous at the bridge road leading south of the city. As he stepped away, he glanced back. Spar was watching him with a look of murder in his eye. Inside the gate, he took the sorrel from her stall and walked her to the cart in its corner of the yard, and he hitched her into harness and walked her by the bit from the yard, talking to her the while in a low voice. In the alley he stood with one hand on her nose and leaned towards her, and murmured, and when she was calm, he climbed onto the cart and set off. The streets were very dark, the city unlit. He made his way through the narrow lanes among the houses, avoiding the main streets as he could. He carried passes for himself and Lewis and Scully, and in the bed of the cart were two rolled bundles of clothes for the spies and a pair of old boots for each. In a quiet side street, under a row of linden trees, he heard a voice call out to him to hold up, and he turned in alarm and saw a cavalry captain approaching him on foot. He thought it strange the man was not on horseback, but he did not ask. The captain asked for his pass, and Edward handed him the paperwork nervously.
"Where you headed at this hour, son?"
The captain looked to Edward like the scion of some plantation bloodline, playing at war. He ran a gloved finger over his nose. He frowned.
"There's a curfew in effect, son."
"Yes, sir." The captain walked around to the bed of the cart, peered into the straw there as if hesitant to touch it. After a moment, he took off his white glove finger by finger, then turned over the straw and withdrew the bundle of clothes. He held up one of the boots.
"What's this?"
Edward shrugged. "I'm to shovel the latrines at Camp Lisa. It's a change of clothes for the ride back. You can smell them from here, I reckon." The captain stared, chewed at his lip, flicked again through the papers. Edward could smell the fresh soap on the captain's skin, and he saw the man was wearing his dress tunic and had shaved that evening. After a moment, the captain grunted, and then he handed back the papers and said,
"All right, son, go ahead."
Edward was sweating heavily along his spine as he clicked the reins and went on. He slowed at each crossing and sat listening, and then continued on his way. He had been careful to grease the axle of the cart, and it rolled with great smoothness through the quiet city. He had given himself 20 minutes to reach the prison, and he would slow and open his pocket watch to gauge the time and then go on. He knew Lewis would be working his way free, even now, and that he would need to make his way soundlessly down 2 floors to reach Scully before both of them could get out to the yard. That way would take them through 2 doors, and along a corridor frequented by the night warden, and once in the yard, the 2 men would need to move some of the trash against the far corner and clamber over the wall into the alley below. All of this would take, by Spar's reckoning, some 14 minutes. He paused, clutching the reins. He rode on. When he reached the prison, he slowed and got down and walked the sorrel into the alley, and he stared at the shadows for some sign. He clicked his tongue twice and listened, but he heard nothing. The brick wall of the prison was very tall and lost in shadow, and the prison beyond it was a huge blackness against the night sky. He left the sorrel standing with her head down and walked into the gloom with his arms outstretched and calling softly, "Hello? Hello?" There was no one. The alley was deserted. He tilted his pocket watch into the weak light from the sky. The half hour came and passed. Then it was 11 o'clock, 11:30. Still there was no movement. The sorrel nickered, and he stood with one hand on her neck in the darkness. She was long-legged and high-backed, and built for running, not pulling loads of any weight. But a war was on, and horses scarce. His thought had been to sacrifice the cart to the weeds, once clear of the city, to split up, and for 2 to ride at speed, and 2 to walk overland. His eyes were sore, and he rubbed them with his thumbs. At the mouth of the alley, something clattered like a bucket knocking over, and he glared fearfully down into the shadows. His mouth was dry. He understood something had gone wrong. At last, he could wait no longer. He glanced around a last time, then snicked the reins. The cart moved down the dirt alley. The wood creaked quietly, the sorrel's hooves almost silent in the dust. It was 30 minutes past midnight. He turned his back on the prison. He rode on. The narrow lanes were deserted, the leafy trees still, the houses dead. They had not come. He rode the cart back through the lightless streets, listening to the harness jingle. He could not think what had gone wrong, but as there had been no ambush, he knew it could not be a betrayal. His first thought had been that Scully or Lewis had been transferred abruptly. His second thought was they had been killed. But for all he knew, they might have simply been too weak to escape, or been caught in the act, or even just lost their nerve. Spar was waiting in the darkness at the bridge road, and Edward felt a dread settle in him at the sight, like a warning of things to come. He slowed, but did not stop, and Spar swung up beside him on the bench. He could see in the man's face that he understood something had gone wrong. He did not ask. Spar got down one block from the hotel and went on ahead. Edward backed the cart into its place in the silent yard and unhitched the sorrel, and removed her harness and walked her into the stable. He was afraid now that someone might hear, but no lights came on in the windows, and if any in that hotel saw, they did not approach. When he went up, the room was dark, but he could see Spar in his hat and coat seated at the edge of his bed, and Edward took the certificates of passage from his pocket and slid them under his mattress. He felt angry and foolish and very frightened. All around them the hotel was still. A faint light was coming in from the street below.
"Well, kid?" Spar said at last.
He shook his head, the gesture meaningless in the gloom. He said angrily,
"I waited in that alley for 2 hours."
After a moment, Spar said, "We go in the morning. You agreed." Now that it had been said aloud, it seemed to Edward a terrible thing.
"You gave Lewis the keys?"
Spar sighed.
"You put them in his hand."
"Lewis and Scully are friends of mine. I don't like leaving them either."
Edward bit at his lip.
"I want to find out what happened. I want to know if there's another chance."
He heard Spar shift on his mattress, kick off a boot, then another. His voice, when he spoke, was measured, wary.
"That's not what we agreed. I'd guess Lewis thought it would have been suicide."
He felt he had failed them, and failed the major back at his camp, and he was afraid he might start to cry. After a long moment, he said quietly,
"For who?"
Spar said nothing. Edward lay back in the darkness, still clothed, and feeling a heaviness in his chest, and hating himself for it. He thought Spar unusually pressed to get him to leave Richmond, and he did not quite understand why. He shifted on to his side, wrapped the pillow up under his ear.
"You know, I never killed no one yet, Mr. Spar," he said. "I guess fate's been saving it up."
Spar was slow to answer. At last, he murmured,
"It's not worth the saving. Weren't you at Cheat Mountain?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you still think you've never killed anyone?"
"Cheat Mountain." Edward ran his tongue over his cracked lips.
"You didn't know what you were shooting. You couldn't see anything for the smoke. It's not the same."
"Killing's killing. In the final reckoning, not seeing it won't work in your favor."
"The final reckoning?"
"Yes."
"You mean like Judgment Day?"
"You don't believe there's going to be one?"
Edward rolled his small shoulder in the gloom, the stiffness in it.
"I think it's already come," he said.
They were quiet a long time then, and Edward folded his arms up under his pillow, and he stared at the ceiling, and he said,
"You sleeping yet?"
"No."
"I keep thinking about Mr. Webster, how he wasn't afraid."
"What makes you think that?"
They listened to the sound of footsteps in the street below pass and fade away into the night.
"Being afraid's nothing, Edward. It means nothing."
"I know it."
"We'll be north of the lines this time tomorrow. Get some sleep."
He closed his eyes and listened to Spar breathing, and he realized he did not trust the man. He opened his eyes.
"What'll the Major say when he sees us?"
"The Major gave me clear instructions," said Spar, and the reply seemed strange to Edward even then. "Go to sleep, Edward."
He did not think he could sleep, but somehow he slept. The night deepened. Sometime before dawn, a man crossed the room, his bare feet making no sound, and a goose pillow clutched in his fists. Leaning over Edward, long and willowy and grey as a ghost, and then placing the pillow firmly but gently over his face, and leaning his weight into it, even as Edward began to thrash and struggle up out of sleep. Then Edward's eyes were open. He was writhing and kicking out. He felt something on his chest, the weight of a man's knee pinioning his arms in place. He could smell the soap on a man's hands, and he twisted to one side, and loosed one arm, and tore at the pillow. A flat, emotionless face. A webbing of scars. Eyes calm, resigned. Then Spar leaned back into the pillow, crushing the life from him. Years later, he would stand with a dying